In order to start, please put the attention on the breath for just a few moments.
Stop. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So our first full day on the retreat. I don't know if you've heard the story of the previous lives of the Buddha. It's worth mentioning here at Amaravati. This is the sort of legendary stories of Buddhist cosmologies. So in some distant time in the past, eons and eons and eons ago, there was a place called Amaravati. And in this place called Amaravati, there was a Brahmin seeker by the name of Sumedha. It's a true story. And, you know, in Buddhist tradition, we have the idea that there are Buddhas arise in an age, and then their teaching manifests, and then when the teaching dies, then another Buddha arises. So throughout time, there have been Buddhas in the past and there have been Buddhas in the future. So it goes. And so at this time, in the time of Amaravati and Sumedha, there was the Buddha Dipankara, past Buddha Dipankara. And when Dipankara came to visit, the Buddha Dipankara came to visit Amaravati, Sumedha saw him and he was so overawed by the radiance and brilliance of this being that he rushed forward, bowed his feet, and made a vow, made a declaration that he would attain to Buddhahood for the sake of all beings. And Dipankara saw that, in fact, Sumedha then would go on through many lifetimes as a Bodhisattva and attain to Buddhahood. And that being then, that was many transformations and became Gautama Buddha, the Buddha of this age, we say, of this teaching. Now, interestingly enough, before Ajahn Sumedho named this place, I think we were chitters, so remember, we had signed the contracts for this place, and Sister Tanisra, I think, was reading in a book this legendary story, and Ajahn Sumedho hadn't heard it. And so she surprised him at one guru meeting and read this out. And he had named this place Amaravati. It was quite a nice story for us, an auspicious story. Now, in the many lives of the Bodhisattva, he developed the foundations for enlightenment, which we call the Bharamitas, the virtuous qualities, which create the foundation for his enlightenment. And these are known as the Jataka tales. And these Jataka tales, they might be pre-Buddhist, I'm not sure, they're sort of Aesop's fables, that type of thing. And they talk about the many, many births and many experiences that the Bodhisattva goes through to develop the perfection of virtuous qualities. Now whether one takes that as fact or not doesn't really matter. It is a kind of metaphor for our own lives that, I found it helpful to contemplate that there are qualities, there are wholesome ways of being, there are wholesome attitudes which are conducive to freedom and to enlightenment. And that helps me when I just look at the experiential, the content of my meditative practice, of my monastic life. Because if I look at the experience and the content, then sometimes it seems pointless, or it seems like I'm not getting anywhere, and that comes up, especially in the early years. It seems very frustrating and very pathetic, very difficult. And so when Ajahn Chah would talk about that, so I remember that I'd go to him with all my complex mental problems and this and that, and he'd say, "Be patient." I'd say, "Thanks a lot. Great, thank you." I sort of want something to just blow my mind away, so that, you know, he would say the magic word, whisper in my ear, or look in my eyes, and I'd be enlightened. It wasn't that easy, unfortunately. And spiritual path isn't easy. It's not easy. I don't find it easy. Any of us find it easy. But what else is there to do? So I always reckon, make money, get a Rolls Royce, make movies. Seems to me a good thing to do this lifetime. And I remember once Ajahn Sumedho saying that to me, you know, in Wat Nanacha, he was giving a talk, and he said, reckoned, if he can just be a slightly kinder person this lifetime, he'll consider it a successful lifetime. And so this is helpful to see that if we just judge the experiential part of our practice, the kind of content, you know, the highs and lows that we go through, then it's still very worldly, so we can get rather pegged into this attitude of success and failure. You know, I had a good sit and I had a bad sit. This kind of chalk up the points, as it were. And then we can get very attached to states of refinement. This is sort of a meditative hang-up, refinement and tranquility. And then we get into the selfish mode of, leave me alone, I'm getting enlightened. You know, don't knock on my door, I'm getting enlightened. I'm not going to cook for you, I'm getting enlightened. Get off my back, I'm getting enlightened. Which is the selfishness of tranquility. And most meditators go through that, I've been through that. And it's a deadening kind of thing. You might get the refinement, but then the human heart is just crushed through selfishness. So if our meditative practice is leading to more alienation and separation from our fellow humans, fellow beings, then that, I don't think that's it. I don't think it could possibly be it. So the development of virtuous quality can be a good way of bearing with the difficulties of the practice. One of those virtuous qualities is metta. And metta is a word we use in the Pali language, and it comes from a teaching called the Brahmaviharas. The Brahmaviharas are called the four divine abidings. And there are ways that one might say that the pure heart manifests when it's not constricted, blocked by egoic selfishness, by greed, hatred, delusion. And these four divine abidings are a sense of concern for the welfare of other beings, which we call metta, or kindness. A sense of compassion for those who are less well off than us. A sense of joy for those who are better off than us. And a sense of peacefulness with the ups and downs of life. Upekkha. This is sister Upekkha. We call it sister equanimity, if you want. Lovely, lovely word, Upekkha. There are these heart factors. It's an interesting way of looking at what might the emotional content of enlightenment, because sometimes we catch these things in very cerebral ways, don't we? We talk about various kinds of teaching, so it can seem very intellectual and analytical. And it has, you know, intellect can be used for considering, but there's also the heart. How does the heart manifest? Because we do feel life, we do emote. They very much manifest as empathy. Empathy and equanimity. Empathy, concern for the welfare of others, compassion for the suffering of others, joy for the goodness of others. There's all modes of empathy, which is very much against the whole way of selfishness, isn't it? Whereas greed, hatred, delusion are very much getting something for me in mind. Okay? And so one of the virtuous qualities that the Bodhisattva developed was this sense of metta, of compassion. And this is a very important concept to understand in conjunction with the whole idea of mindfulness or wakefulness. Because people who come to Buddhism tend to usually be very kind of highly intellectual types, usually not aware from the neck down, very much in the head, cerebral. Quite often we have very good critical faculties. We can really develop maybe computer science or all kinds of skills with thought, and so we're very good at criticizing and analyzing and seeing differences, which can be useful, but it also can turn on us where we are constantly very judgmental. And so metta is an attitude of the heart, an attitude of the practice, which is necessary for true mindfulness to function, I should say. Because, as I said earlier today, mindfulness, I think, has to have an attitude of caring in it. Like I always, like, if I have a child in front of me and the child is crying, I have to care for it to understand why it's crying, don't I? If I just kind of grab it and try to make it better, I say, shut up, stop crying, or whatever, I cannot possibly understand why the child is crying. See? So I have to care. And then when I care, I can see, the child, has a cut on its hand, or it just feels lonely, whatever, and I can do whatever is appropriate to heal the suffering of the child. So in the same with our own practice, our own hearts and minds, we need self-empathy. We need to care for the conditioning, the karma we have. But who wants to care for a blowing mind? Who wants to care for dullness? Who wants to care for a back which hurts? Who wants to care for restlessness? Those are such things that we don't really care for. And so it's very hard to be mindful of them. We care to get rid of them usually. We care to get beautiful states of mind, tranquility, loving states and things like that, which is fairly normal. But if we cannot care for all of it, the whole range of human experience, then we can't really be free, I think. Yeah? So caring is what we mean by metta. Now, that the practice that we do, may I be well, may you be well, is done in various ways. And sometimes people think that metta is that you always like everyone. And so it's kind of seen as a sort of an emotional necessity that you always love everyone or that you like life. And it's very much geared upon liking and positiveness. But that's impossible, at least I think. Eh? Can you like every moment and every person you meet? It would be a pretty heavy bit of baggage to carry around. So beginning with this being and the karma of this being, the ups and downs of being experienced, is to begin to care for the whole of it. The negativity, the boredom, let's say like dullness. You're practicing meditation and you're feeling dull and sleepy. To understand dullness and to not be bound by it, you have to care for it. Like, actually, what is this stuff called dullness? What is it doing to me? Whereas the kind of habitual response is get rid of the dullness and get to the tranquility, and that won't work. This willfulness won't work. There has to be wisdom around it. So this is the way we read about metta, is that the Buddha did various wonderful things with other people, so we think we have to do that. But it begins with this just very self-concern. Not selfishness, kind of self-obsession, it's not that, kind of me and my meditation trip, but caring for this being and its karma, its mental formations, its emotions. So that's something that we can develop as an attitude by just sitting here and thinking it. When I sit here, I say, may I be well, may I be free, may I be well, may I be free. If you do that for an hour, then if tomorrow morning I wake up Oh, you idiot, you overslept again, Viradhamma, your practice isn't any good, all that habitual negativity. Having done something else, having put another kind of intention into the heart, then we tend to hear that negativity more clearly. You see, that negativity still has its momentum, doesn't it? Self-disparagement or other disparagement, it's still a kind of karmic echo in the mind. But having cultivated something which is a balance helps us to awaken to the negativity. And this is how we can use various strategies, various practices, not to get rid of feelings of unkindness or feelings of negativity, but to awaken to them. Now, with the practice of metta, quite often people think, well, you have to get rid of the anger and get the metta on top. So, and sometimes we feel angry, right? Or negative or whatever, and then and you just try to be kind. May I be well, may they be well. And you hate, you know, hate this guy's guts. And then you, rather than being honest about that, you say, may he be well, may he be well. You cover it over with this kind of smarmy voice. And then maybe you punch him in the head after or something. And it gets very confused because we think that we're not supposed to feel anger. You know, we think we're supposed to feel negativity. We're supposed to get rid of that stuff because the teaching says non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. And then we get all very, very confused. So, but if we just begin, first of all, this is the way it is now. I feel this way. That's a welcoming, isn't it? It's a welcoming into consciousness, the totality. And metta is a total kind of practice. It's non, it doesn't say, I'm going to welcome in these feelings and emotions, but these guys are bad, I have to get rid of them. No, it's allowing it all to happen. That's not condoning negativity. It's not indulging in negativity, it's just recognizing negativity as it manifests. So it's very, very important, this attitude. So I would ask, like during this retreat, really contemplate your own attitudes. Like if you sit for an hour and it's just all over the shop, you know, your mind is all over the place, you can't sit still, it seems hopeless. What's the attitude afterwards? Do you get down on yourself? Or do you just learn from it? Learn about the mind. What is the kind of attitude? What kind of self-thoughts are running through your mind? And if they are ones of judgment rather than consideration, they're different. Like I can judge my, like I can say, maybe I sleep in the morning and so on, and then I judge myself, oh, I'm no good for sleeping in. That's not metta. But if I say, why? What's happening? What's happening to me? If I see cause and effect, that's different. I can still look and discriminate and watch, but it's coming from a sense of caring. Yeah? So this is one of the, what we call barometers, one of the virtuous factors of the enlightened heart. And this is why I think one of the reasons compassion and kindness is so much stressed in Buddhism, not just to other beings, but for the world as it manifests in consciousness. Because what is the world? It's just this moment, isn't it? These feelings, these thoughts, these perceptions, these memories, these ideas, these bodily things. It's the world coming and going as we're experiencing it. So to love the world in that way, in a very immediate way. Very practical. And it's very helpful in the practice. So to do this often is good. You can't OD on metta, I don't think. To actually bring that attitude to mind, keep bringing it up into mind, and then caring for the whole kind of karmic makeup. Now we another of the virtuous qualities which are very, very fundamental to the practice is patience. One of the big secrets, I think, or the secret to samadhi practice is patience. Because we can be so very impatient for results. We want to get something, huh? So like to actually be patient with a whole out-breath. And just let the in-breath come in. But deeper than that, is that we do have karmic tendencies which we're involved in. Right? So we come to this retreat, and you've got your stuff and I've got mine. You know, you've been involved with people, you've got emotions, you've got childhood conditioning, you have social conditioning, you're in a different environment, right? If you've got a different bed, a different meal, different people live with you, living in kind of dormitory facility maybe, there are a lot of changes there. And so perhaps you're going to feel reactions to that. You know, maybe tonight you'll be afflicted by a snorer. I hope not. That maybe there'll be someone using a chainsaw on their nose or something all night. And then, it's a hard one, you know. I need my sleep. I want to meditate. And so patience is very important quality of the practice. Because as we live our lives, we get our buttons pressed, don't we? When you're comfortable, when you've got everything you want, you know, you've got the kind of food you like, you have your own bed, you have your own routine, you have your own friends, you have your own flat, you know, you can see a pretty together guy. Yeah, it's going pretty good. And you take all that away and you change it, and then you're free of the tendencies to want life to be your way, my way. And so you feel irritated maybe, or you feel restless, or you feel bored. Yeah, those things are very important to allow them to manifest, but not to attach to them. That's where the practice of patience is. To actually bear with these things, to bear with them. There's very much the kind of cleansing process we go through in the spiritual life. The practice is always immediate. It's not like you're getting anywhere. But it's always, right now, you're patient with this thing which is arising. So we do experience a lot of negativity. Like it or not, most beings do, don't we? Experience negative, like the bodily karma can be very negative sometimes, can it? Pain and discomfort, emotional karma sometimes, that can be a part of our lives, and then we try to get rid of that. But to be the witness to that, to patiently bear with these things, is a factor of enlightenment. So if you're having difficulties in your practice, or in your life in general, right, so well, maybe this is a chance to develop patience. You don't develop patience when everything's going good. So, when was the last time you developed patience when you were happy? it's a contradiction in terms. You don't develop patience when you have everything you want, everyone's nice to you, your body's behaving itself. You don't, do you? When do you develop patience? When your body's not behaving itself, when people are difficult and so on. And that's a tremendously important virtue, because so much of the world does not fit our desire patterns. So much of the world is not pleasant. Human life, human society has a lot of discord in it. Weather can be very, very painful on the body. Old age, the aging process, can be very unpleasant, very uncomfortable, right? And that's just the way of, that's just the nature of it. It's neither right nor wrong, it's not pessimistic, it's just the way it is. Monastic life has a lot of friction in it. You know, you get 30 characters together. We're all pretty eccentric just to do this, I think. Get us all together. We're all highly opinionated and highly motivated, too. There's a lot of stuff that goes on. I want to use all that just to be patient with differences. Now, if there's that foundation of patience, then as life changes in its funny ways, the stillness of the mind is retained, the steadiness, the centeredness of the heart is retained. But if there's no patience, as soon as we get out of our comfort zone, we get blown away. Right? So now, like on this retreat, try to bring that forth when there is something difficult going on. Okay, it's a chance to develop patience. What is patience? So you bring that idea to mind. And this is how you contemplate a word. Rather than saying, I should be patient, bring that word to mind. Patience. What is patience? What is that? What is that quality? This is the way we use the contemplative aspect of consciousness. And then as you bring that word to mind, you'll see, well, you'll notice what impatience is, don't you? What's patience? What does it mean to be patient, to bear with? To bear with unfulfilled desire, to bear with maybe negativity of some sort. Right? Contemplate that word. And then that, as you contemplate that word, you remember that word, what that means, in a deeper way than just the word. And that begins a foundation for freedom. Because, for me, I've had, you know, nice experiences in meditation and good insights and so on. But much of monastic life has just been like watching my own karma, like the karma of like, say, when I went first to Northeast Thailand. I had dropped out of university, studying engineering at the University of Toronto, and traveled around for three and a half years, North Africa, Europe, and Asia, lived in India a year. Oh, very free. carefree kind of life, right? And pretty simply. And then I got to Thailand, Wat Pho Phong. I had no books. Quite often there was no English-speaking people. There was no coffee. There were no cigarettes. There was one meal a day. There were no movies. Living celibate. Heat. It was very boring. Except for the one meal a day. And all of a sudden, all that range of sensual delight that I used to take part in, all of a sudden was focused on a mango. Or it was something really absurd. And just the kind of greed and restlessness around food. Now, so what I saw in that was the kind of how addicted I was to sense contact. And not, you know, not, and it wasn't, you know, it was probably just a normal North American guy who did what North Americans do. I wasn't extreme in any way, but all of a sudden, all of my greed, hatred, delusion was focused on this mango. I want a bigger mango. I want a bigger banana. And at one level, I could see how silly it was and absurd, but the greed was very real. This was serious. I'd kill for extra banana. And the reason, of course, was that all that desire is now focused on one thing. And this is what happens on our retreat to a certain extent, you know. Because we haven't got a range of things that we can distract into, quite often we get focused on little things. You know, someone just shifting in the shrine room, or, you know, someone slurping their soup at meal time. It can be silly things, little things like that, you know. Or we can get obsessed with some silly fantasy. Right? And this is quite often what happens when you get a sense of deprivation. Your mind just latches onto some silly little thing. Like in Thailand, it was especially so. There was just nothing except that meal. And it was a boring food, too. You know, sticky rice and a few frogs sometimes. Kind of not very passionate. And yet, the mind is very much entertaining these things. Well, then Ajahn Chah, oh, I've got so much greed. He says, be patient. Thanks a lot. Be patient. I just hear this again and again because I have karma. You know, having indulged in sensuality, the result when that was cut was that there was unfulfilled desire. And that unfulfilled desire is a kind of yearning, isn't it? And just to bear with that and be with that. And I can see that much of the tranquility that I experience now and calmness, beauty of the mind, is by just bearing with unfulfilled desire. Bearing with not having that extra mango or whatever I wanted. Right? And so patience is an incredible virtue. Or let's say like the feelings of anger that I've experienced. I used to be able to really get into a rage, you know, a really kind of black anger. And then I remember one of the first years, I was just really angry. Ajahn Anando came to me with this Mahayana book on loving all beings. And he presented this, you know, that you should love your mother, you should love your father, you should love your teacher. And I read it, I went and belted the guy in the face. And I said, get off my back, will you? So I had all this anger, and then I felt guilty about it. Oh gosh, I have to love everyone. What am I going to do now with all this anger? I was totally confused. Right? And I'd go to Ajahn Chah and say, be patient. Thanks a lot. And yet he was right, because there was the karma of anger. That was a tendency which I had to work with. And no amount of me loving everyone was going to sort that one out. First of all, I had to just love the anger. I just had compassion for that kind of process. Right? Now, I hadn't done any meditation before, so you know, I experienced some pretty extreme stuff in those first years. Because some of you, you know, you much more developed and so on than that. But just the idea, like let's say if someone presses your buttons, this retreat, and let's say it's within the boundaries of the retreat, it's not immoral or anything, and you feel agitated, then now that agitation as it arises is actually quite all right, because that's a latent tendency. It's a karmic tendency in you. Now if you can be patient with that, not hate yourself, not hate that person, but that patience allows that tendency towards anger to cease. And as you allow these things to cease, you don't have any more buttons. And liberation is no more buttons. In a way, isn't it? Huh? Where you can be anywhere, anytime, any place, huh? Rather than in an ashram room. So see, so they're really kind of golden opportunities. So when you feel, say, irritation, great, go to it and say, what does patience mean here? Contemplate, what does that word patience mean? Not that you, no, I have to be patient now. That's another kind of repressive trip you can lay on yourself. What does it mean to be patient? What does it mean to bear with something unpleasant? So you get in touch with that, what that virtuous quality might mean. Right? So those two, kindness, you can see like caring for, and then like the patience, bearing with it, allows a lot of the karmic tendencies to cease. Among these virtues, the virtuous quality which the Buddha could never go against was called satya, truthfulness. But truthfulness is not just like refraining from lying. It's like, I think for me, it's a determination that if I suffer, it's my fault. Not my fault, it's something I have to look at. Something I have to deal with now. And I've always found that very fruitful, very healthy, very helpful. And we've been talking about that, about like Amaravati is a very complex place, and we're always having meetings trying to make it a better place, which is okay. But the bottom line is always got to be, no matter what Amaravati is or the people are, if I suffer, it's something I have to work with. And this is what we mean by truthfulness, right? That if one blames others, or even one blames himself, or one escapes, then one has missed an opportunity. Sometimes a strategic retreat is necessary. Life becomes overwhelming. Fine, so this may be a strategic retreat, I don't know. But the idea that, you know, if something is disturbing the heart, that the place to work with it is now and here, in the heart now. And I found that, you know, that if I tend to blame others for my suffering, then that lack of honesty about that I'm creating this problem, prevents me from liberating the heart from that problem. Very, very important. Now, truthfulness isn't self-hatred. It's not like saying, oh, you fool, you're dumb, or you're making a problem again. No, this is something that needs to be understood. I need to understand this particular limitation. You know, so like, let's say at Amaravati, I like to play around with long-term commitments. So I said to myself before I came, I say, I'm going to stay here until Ajahn Sumedho dies. Or I said, I stay here for 20 years. Now, it was very inspiring to do that. A couple of days ago, I came up with my first one. Oh, no, not this for 20 years. And that's how you use, like commitment. You know, you say, I'm going to stick with this. You know, and you can say that and feel very inspired about it. It's easy to say, hey, it makes you feel good, doesn't it? But then you hit something. Oh no, what have I done? 20 years with this thing or this person. And then the person or the situation that's kind of triggering off something, you say, now I'm going to determine, I'm going to work with this. I'm going to find freedom within this difficulty. And that's what truthfulness is about. That ability to take that thing which is causing fear or anxiety or stress and to try to work with that. That's not an absolute. I'm not saying, you know, that, you know, you're in some relationship and you're getting beat up and you go to the hospital every week to say, I have to stay with this. It's not an absolute. But as much as possible, you say, this person, this situation, I'm going to try to find freedom within this. Eh? And that's very, very rewarding, that. Because it really kind of forces you to look and to take responsibility. And when we take responsibility in those weak points that we have, we gain our strength. We liberate the karma that we're stuck by. So that sense of, you know, really being honest about your own practice, being honest about. So if you are moving away from something because it's overwhelming, fine, that's okay. But be honest about it. Don't be careful of the rational mind. You know, the rationalizing mind which says, I need this and I need that, and if I only had this, I only had that. It's a very dangerous one. Yeah? You know, and that's the one I quite often get in the mornings. Oh gosh, you know, I had so many meetings yesterday. I need an extra hour of sleep. I need an extra 2, no, an extra 4 hours sleep. The rationalizing mind doing that. Yeah? the truthfulness is the sense of really going to the heart, going to the suffering, going to the tension, and liberating the heart from that by understanding it. The truthfulness, right? And that's one that the Buddha could never go, the Bodhisattva could never go against, because his whole determination was the understanding of truth. Understanding of truth of the way things are. Right? And in Buddhism we'd say, if there's tension, if there's suffering, there's something to be understood that we haven't understood yet. There's some attachment that we need to grapple with, we need to understand. You have to be very determined. The adhitana, we call it, one of the virtuous qualities. You have to be very, very determined in the spiritual life, because it's not easy. I don't think it is. I think very few people find it very easy. I think very few. You read about people like Ramana Maharshi. Many of you might have read about him. He's a famous Indian saint that died in like 1950. He was, I think he was 16 when he had a feeling that he wanted to contemplate death. He laid down. 3 days later, he was enlightened. Nice one, huh? I tried that. I fell asleep. It didn't work. Good karma. Yeah? He had good karma. And so you read about people like that, and sometimes you might meet them, but most of us have work to do. In the text, they say there are four kinds of practitioners. There's the practitioner who has quick progress with little suffering. There's the practitioner who has quick progress with a lot of suffering. There's a practitioner who has slow progress with little suffering, and there's a practitioner who has slow progress with a lot of suffering. And most of us think we're in the last category. But actually we're not. To be here, we're not. But in terms of determination, you've got to have, I think you need fire in this practice. You need to have the conviction that you can be free, that there is enlightenment, that there is the transcendent, that there is the deathless, and you need to be determined that you will settle for nothing less. I think that's the holy life. Right? The Buddhist path isn't just humanism. There is transcendence, there is enlightenment, there is the deathless, there is the realization of that, which is very immediate, very close. And that fire, this is why I love Ajahn Sumedho so much, because he's got that fire where he just will not compromise. He will settle for not. He won't settle for second best. Right? Part of right view in Buddhism is that there is enlightenment, there is the deathless. It's part of right view. And to keep that in mind is a kind of determination that we will not settle for just sense happiness or comfort. Right? Determination. So that applies to that whole area of being patient, caring for, truthfulness, and being determined. They're really a package, you know. They support each other. So if you do go through difficulties, you're going to be determined. I'm going to understand this. Not in a kind of machismo way. You're going to get rid of it. But there is something to be understood there. I must understand it. I had one time in my practice where I had this really difficult person who had a lot of problems with authority figures, and senior monks get authority projections put onto them, and so. It's just so difficult, difficult person. And I just went through a whole year of not being able to deal with it. But I was just, I was really determined, and I realized that my problem was fear. And this person knew how to press my fear button. But it just took a lot of time. But and the superficial part of me wanted to blame him, wanted to kill him. And, you know, that was the superficial part, which, you know, why does he do this to me and so on. But the deeper part said, no. Within this you have to be free too. And I just kept working with it, and that determination, then I had a good insight. It took a long time. So determination is the willingness to, you know, really bear with, and when we don't understand our karma, we just have to go back into it. And the nature of delusion is that it's deluding. It's the way of it. And so we're so close to our own karma, sometimes we don't see what the problem is. Other people might see. The therapist might see, or the monk might say, oh, that's obvious, oh, it's fever, anger, fine. But then we are so close to it sometimes, to our own delusion, that sometimes it just takes a determination to look and to look and to look until we penetrate and we understand, oh, I see what I'm doing. Yeah. our ability to stick with it. So say in terms of this retreat now, you know, most people on retreats want to leave, I think, the common feeling. The kind of, become maybe in the beginning, think, oh great, oh what a relief, no responsibilities. Then 2 days later, what the hell am I doing here? Why did I come? This is a bad mistake or something. And that's where the determination comes in, doesn't it? No, I'm going to use this framework to understand that negative state of mind. Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. You know, the determination to be with an out-breath, to be with an in-breath. So determination is a quality we use a lot in samadhi practice. So consider that sometimes we're developing qualities which are not an experience, like the quality of patience. You can feel very restless for a whole meditation, and it can be actually a very powerful meditation because you haven't run away on that restlessness. Right? Whereas if you're judging your practice, I want peace, then you think, oh, it was a restlessness, I had a bad meditation. Don't get caught by that one. You know, like Ajahn Chah would say, if you want to meditate, meditate. If you don't want to meditate, meditate. And this has been a big treasure for me of monastic life, is that just the discipline, you know. So often, who wants to hear that morning chanting again? God, I don't want to sit through this again. Mosquitoes biting me. But just every day, every day, every day, every day. That kind of steadiness of practice, huh? You build on that, build on that. So in terms of this retreat, see it like if you have a difficult period, so you're developing patience, you're developing determination, you're developing a caring attitude for something which is hard to care for. You're developing truthfulness and honesty around these issues. And then those things are a tremendous foundation for samadhi, tremendous foundation for the spiritual life. Right? Even though the experience might not be very pretty, might not be very exciting or interesting, right? But there's something deeper going on. And these are what we call paramitas, the virtuous qualities, the foundation for enlightenment. There's lots more of those, but I think for tonight that's probably plenty to digest, so I'll leave that for reflection tonight. You want to